Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I was actually really debating whether or not to play that last song. That song was by a group of American soldiers, actually, during the Vietnam War, soldiers who end up rejecting the war, and who actually made an album, We Say No to Your War. And that song is basically one of the most almost unvarnished songs about, like, the atrocities which took place in the Vietnam War. And it's hard to listen to. You know, it really is. It's a really hard thing to listen to. But the reason why I wanted to play that is just to once again give, we don't get this kind of picture about what things were like, what the reality was back then. It's very much whitewashed, and it's really what we're going to talk about here. I'm here with Brendan Campisi.
Hello.
He's a comrade from the Uncommunist League, and I've had him on the show a number of times before. We've talked about a number of different things. I remember we talked about the Black Panther Party back in the day, and we talked about a number of other topics. I think I've had him on, like, in other anti-war topics, actually, like around Remembrance Day.
Yes.
In the past, but this is the first time this year. That's for sure. So it's wonderful to have you back on the show, Brendan. It's really good to have you here. Always.
It is very good to be back. Always good to be here.
Yeah. Even though obviously the subject we're dealing here is quite difficult to talk about, but really what one of the reasons why we're getting into this is because, like, the kind of whitewashing of the Vietnam War, which goes on now, and, you know, sanitizing it in many ways to justify wars going on now. And future wars, and the basically the agenda of the American national security state going forward. You know, there's a lot of propaganda, a lot of myths, and what I expressed at the beginning of the show, like the whole, that whole well-intentioned argument that we get, you know, it's like, oh, it's all good intention, just went wrong. Or something like that. We get that narrative a lot, but it's certainly not the only myth that we get. So maybe you could sort of delve into, first of all, talk a little bit about this. There was one particular new film.
Sure.
That's dealing with the Vietnam War, which really is quite terrible and gets into, like, really spreads all this mythology around. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So, the occasion for this discussion, to a large extent, is this documentary that's just been broadcast on PBS that was made about the Vietnam War by Ken Burns, famous American documentarian who produced this iconic documentary about the American Civil War and about, you know, things like baseball and just sort of things that are sort of taken to be iconic aspects of the American experience and American history. And obviously, the Vietnam War is that, among other things. So now he's taken on that subject. And there's been an outpouring of a very, very sharp and astute criticism of this documentary by historians, by specialists, by people who actually know what they're talking about when it comes to the war in Vietnam. So we're going to be, you know, drawing on that a little bit. But somebody pointed out there's a couple of things about sort of the perspective and the sourcing and the backing of this documentary that make it sort of inherently suspect. In a lot of ways, although it's in some ways it's more subtle than it could be. So I'll get into what I mean by that in a second. As many people have pointed out, this documentary was funded in part by the Bank of America. And as soon as I heard about that, I remembered there was a piece of agitprop from the movement against the war in Vietnam, where some anti-war activists created fake Bank of America checks. And the difference between these checks and a regular Bank of America check were, besides the fact that America was spelled with a K, obviously a stylistic convention of the time, which, you know, sometimes we still do that. But the background image was a hut burning in Vietnam, right? And this was the obvious sort of message here is to draw the connection between American finance capital and the destruction of Vietnam. And specifically, you know, they were holding Bank of America responsible for this. So I thought there was a bit of a dark irony, right, in Bank of America now funding this documentary that's supposed to tell the basic truth about the war in Vietnam. One of the critiques that's come out of this documentary points out that there's a pretty significant problem in terms of who is being interviewed. In some ways, it's better than it could be in that there is a significant representation of voices from Vietnam. But I think that makes it, they're not just talking to Americans. I think in the long run, that sort of makes it more insidious and successful propaganda rather than actually being fair.
Right.
One of the sort of the devices of this documentary is that they say, we're not interviewing experts. We're not interviewing historians and, talking heads. We're just going to talk to the people who lived through this war and who experienced it. And there's obviously a number of problems with that, just with the bias that everyone is going to bring, from their own experiences, and the fact that the human memory is extremely fallible. But that's just something that's part of any kind of historical work. Specific problems with this historical work is that a number of people are presented as not being experts who are, in fact, longstanding members of the U.S. Imperialist state apparatus in various agencies. And there's a number of people with sort of bloody careers who are interviewed in this documentary who had bloody careers that began in Vietnam and have continued all the way down to the present day. One person who's interviewed in this documentary and simply, I think he's simply credited as like an American official or something like that. This is the device. They say that they're not talking to experts. So they talk to this rogues gallery of counterinsurgency ghouls, and they just refer to them as, a U.S. government official, or like by whatever military role they played when they were in Vietnam. So they talk to people like John Negroponte, who, starting in Vietnam, was, committed all kinds of horrible crimes in a number of different countries. I think he was the U.S. ambassador to Honduras in the 1980s and helped orchestrate, a horrible, brutal counterinsurgent war there, and then would eventually, go on to be one of the architects of the war in Iraq in the 2000s. So there's a number of people like this who are given the opportunity to speak in this documentary without it really being acknowledged, who they are. So that's, those are some problems in terms of, before even getting into the content, in terms of like what's the framing of all of this, what's the context, and who's sort of being allowed to participate and to use this project to get their perspective across. As far as the actual content, there's a number of sort of basic myths that exist in American kind of popular and like official, narratives about the war in Vietnam that are reproduced in this documentary. And the one we've talked about is the idea of good intentions. And sort of the other sort of two most important ones are the idea of balancing, the idea of that you have to take into account both sides. Jimmy Carter famously, or should be infamously, said in the late 1970s that the destruction was mutual. And even though that's absolutely an obscene statement, given like what you were talking about with this, the actual impact of the war in Vietnam, the fact is, no American civilians died in Vietnam. Only 58,000, 58,000 Americans died in the Vietnam War, and they were all military, whereas 4 million Vietnamese people were killed. On the most basic level, it's obscene to say that the destruction was mutual, like Carter did, great liberal hero Jimmy Carter. And it's absolutely obscene to create the illusion of balance on the one hand because of the just absolutely staggeringly different impacts of the war on Vietnamese people and on Americans, and also because there is no equivalence between people who are invading and occupying a country and people who are fighting for their liberation. So there's the myth of balance, and there's also, and this is what actually is the avowed purpose of this documentary, is to allow for healing between Americans, to heal the divisions that existed between Americans over the Vietnam War, and to heal some sort of healing process between Americans and Vietnamese. And then there's sort of kind of like a subliminal sort of fourth myth that sort of kind of surfaces at certain points in this documentary, which is sort of moving from these sort of liberal narratives about the war in Vietnam to a basically fascist one, which is the implication that the war could have been won, that the war was fundamentally righteous and just, and that America could have won if it hadn't been betrayed at home by the left, by, you know, liberals who weren't willing to do what was necessary to win the war, by the anti-war movement, and especially sort of the anti-war movement incarnated in the particular figures of demonized women, especially like Jane Fonda. So there's this, this basically fascist masculinist narrative that, America's kind of military masculinity was strong enough to win the war, but, you know, weaker forces, on the home front essentially betrayed America. And there's one particular review of this documentary that came out that talks about sort of how that particular narrative kind of surfaces, in that they discuss at some point a woman who became active in the anti-war movement while her husband was a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. And the politics of, you know, American prisoners in Vietnam are very, very complicated. But, you know, for some people, obviously, having a relative, you know, having their son or brother imprisoned in Vietnam made them sort of more reactionary and more committed to the war. But there was also a significant section of people who started to question the war and who turned against the war because of that. And for several years, the main kind of link between Americans at home and American prisoners in Vietnam was through the anti-war movement, because the government in socialist Vietnam was willing to allow, you know, anti-war activists. And there were people like David Dellinger, who were very, very active in, you know, going to the prisoners of war and making sure that, you know, making sure that they were treated well and making sure that they could send letters and, you know, doing the sort of basic humanitarian work of, you know, looking after these prisoners. So they discuss a case of this woman who became active in the anti-war movement, and the implication is that she was being exploited by the North Vietnamese, basically into betraying her husband. And then when her husband came back from the war, their relationship fell apart, and they got a divorce. And there's a line, and this is apparently something of a cliche, although I'd never heard of it before. This is something that this former prisoner of war said, was that that American women started wearing miniskirts during the time that he had been in a North Vietnamese prison camp. And sort of there's this very sort of strange, rich, you know, again, I would say basically fascist symbolism here, where you have the anti-war movement being portrayed as basically this basically feminine sort of entity that's undermining the strength of America, and that while the war was going on, America's sort of moral character was declining, and that's why they lost the war, even though they didn't necessarily, you know, have to, as far as the actual, you know, military strength available and whatever. So there's a strange sort of coexistence. Well, I don't think it's that strange, but there's a striking coexistence of the liberal narrative about the war, which is that it was a mistake, and the fascist narrative about the war, which is very, very, very closely analogous to the, you know, the German stab in the back legend that coexists in this documentary, and I think in a lot of American discussions of the war.
Hmm. Yeah, because obviously the mythology, I mean, this extends to, like, throughout the education system as well. This extends, like, it's obviously in the media. Basically, almost the entire way the war is portrayed, like throughout the political establishment and whatnot, is through those two lenses, like that whole mythology. But once again, getting into the actual history in terms of the anti-war movement,
right?
Like, so maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, I mean, these people who are actually demonized,
sure,
like by these myths,
right?
Like these people who fought back, and like we were incredibly diverse array,
yeah,
of causes, of people, of people who were radicalized. We even touched on this when we talked about the Black Panthers, and we talked about the different forces in Black America,
right?
Who radicalized at this time, obviously for different reasons, and different things came together at this time, different forces, historical forces. So maybe we could unpack some of that.
Sure. So this ties into again one of these narratives that's sort of put forward in this documentary, which is that the division between Americans over the war was fundamentally a bad thing, and that Americans should Americans of that generation and the ones that follow should be able to bury the hatchet and sort of restore. And this is, again, something that comes up in a couple of these reviews, is this sort of the mythic idea that America before the Vietnam War was a basically, placid, was a basically a united society. And then the war divided America. Obviously, the war did divide Americans to a large extent. But America in 1960 was not a united society. America in 1960 was a society under the pall of McCarthyist repression, and where Black people were rising up for their rights and their dignity, and that was polarizing all kinds of Americans. It was inspiring many members of the other oppressed groups in American society, and it was inspiring a small group of white people, and it was terrifying large numbers of white Americans. So that was the America that went to war in Vietnam, was not a calm, united society. And fundamentally, the polarization of Americans over the war in Vietnam was a good thing. It was one of the best things that ever happened to Americans. It was one of the moments in history when probably the largest number of Americans started to have something of the fog sort of cleared away from them and started to understand, at least some significant number of Americans, started to understand the reality of their society and the reality of their country's place in the world, which is a very, very rare thing. I'd say more Americans understood more about that in 1973 when the war ended than do today. I think that's actually very, very clear. So the idea that America needs to heal from the divisions, and this is something that's been put forward since the war was going on, is really destructive and really reactionary, because it was fundamentally... people were learning lessons about the reality of their society. So basically, the anti-war movement at the beginning was sort of the usual suspects in the form of the organized far left, which in America, people in America generally did not start paying much attention to the war until 1965. It had already been going on for a long time, obviously. In some ways, the war had been going on virtually uninterruptedly since the 1940s. But the main period of American involvement had started in the early 1960s. But in 1960, very, very few Americans knew where Vietnam was. And so the anti-war movement at the beginning consisted mostly of the organized far left and small sort of pacifist organizations. Almost incidentally, I just find this funny, almost every socialist organization in America that existed at that time will tell you that they were the ones who had the first major demonstration against the war in Vietnam. So it's very difficult to say which one was. And, you can never tell, 50 years later whether who was paying attention to this demonstration. You can have the record in your party's newspaper that the demonstration happened. But, yeah, I just find that funny. But very, very quickly, the anti-war movement began to grow. And it especially sort of grew among two constituencies. Or one constituency was sort of divided into two parts. The first people to take up the struggle against the war in Vietnam in significant numbers were young Black people who'd been politicized by the civil rights movement. The first major organization in the United States outside of, again, these traditional anti-war groups and the tiny, tiny socialist left to come out against the war in Vietnam was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And very, very early on, they made political criticisms of the war that were way more advanced than would be mainstream for several years afterwards. And I don't know if they used the word imperialism. I don't remember that right now. But they made an essentially anti-imperialist argument against the war from the beginning of their involvement on the issue in 1965. And they connected their own cause with the cause of the people in Vietnam and the cause of oppressed, colonized people of color all over the world. So that connection is being made very, very early on in the history of the movement by... by the sort of the vanguard of black youth in America. Things that, you know, large numbers of white people, even on the left, would not be saying for years afterwards. It was sort of focused on the idea that the war was a mistake, and sort of the learning curve would be, you know, would be a lot steeper for people, you know, for people with different experiences of the reality of America at home. You know, it's more or less easy to understand the reality of American imperialism abroad. So the second constituency following on the sort of the black youth movement is the white youth movement. And sort of the main kind of organization that jumps in and sort of makes itself the leading organization of the movement for a period is Students for a Democratic Society, which it sort of went back and forth for several years sort of on the line of their own kind of internal divisions, because there were people in SDS who wanted to sort of use students as a shock troop to rebuild the entire left in America, and there were people who thought that it was more important to organize campuses themselves, and there were people who wanted to do mostly, you know, community organizing in poor neighborhoods, and the war didn't really matter that much to them. But once it did, once SDS did enter the movement, they very, very quickly realized that the war was becoming sort of the second main issue that young people in America were becoming politicized and radicalized on after, you know, the civil rights movement and, you know, anti-racist struggle more generally. So basically in the next sort of couple of years after that, 65, 67, the movement just mushrooms. And it also sort of develops ideologically. And people outside of, you know, the existing socialist organization start talking about, or start sort of working towards an understanding of the war as imperialist. It takes a while, because the starting point is basically Cold War liberalism, and then sort of the next kind of available critique that people had was to simply say that the war was a mistake. But as the war continued, more and more people, first of all, the movement grew, especially. There's a, you know, very, very close relationship between the number of troops being deployed, because from 1965 to 1968, the center of American strategy was just to send more and more and more and more troops. That was sort of the conception in the Johnson administration. And it got to the point where in 1968, there were 500,000 Americans in Vietnam. So as long as that curve was, you know, ascending, as long as there were more and more and more soldiers being sent to Vietnam, more and more and more people had to, you know, to think about what they were going to do if they got drafted. And, you know, Lyndon Johnson was the best recruiter for the anti-war movement, right? Because they just kept escalating the war. And also, continuously from 1965 to 1968, the absolutely, you know, brutal bombing of North Vietnam was just constant. So you had the constantly escalating land war in South Vietnam, the constantly escalating land war over North Vietnam, and it just became impossible to ignore. And by 1967-68, the war is the central political topic in the United States, and people are beginning to mobilize against the U.S. war on Vietnam all over the world, right? It becomes sort of the main kind of international issue for a decade, basically, and millions of young people around the world are radicalized and politicized around the war in Vietnam, especially because It's difficult to remember, but sort of people in most of, you know, in Western Europe and in sort of most Western and Western aligned, you know, societies during the Cold War period were taught to believe that America was great, right? There was sort of like there was this kind of this very, very pervasive pro-American sentiment in, you know, in most Western and sort of major capitalist societies that the generation sort of the immediate post-war period had grown up with. And then suddenly America is doing, you know, is doing this in Vietnam. And it absolutely shattered the international image of America. And it forced millions of people around the world to ask very, very hard questions about global capitalism. Because as one really, really powerful analysis was written immediately after the Tet Offensive by a young Goran Therborn, a really, really great piece called From Petrograd to Saigon, said that, you know, sooner or later, the question of Vietnam forces you to question global capitalism, because the United States is not a marginal capitalist country. It's not a country in crisis. You know, it's not an exceptional regime like Italy or Nazi Germany. It's the most powerful country in the world, living under a normal bourgeois democracy at the center of the global imperialist system. And yet, in Vietnam, it is committing the same crimes as Nazism. Why? Because that is the essential logic of imperialism as a social system.